You know, I've heard about this for a number of years, and I've always been fascinated. I saw a program on, Travel Channel, History Channel, one of those. I'm always looking around to find new things if I am watching TV, and they were talking about these giant pterodactyls, apparently, these birds that people had witnessed to, and there was a story about somebody, I think, in Illinois or Ohio, and this little child was actually picked up by one of these things, and the mother ran after it, and it dropped the child, but didn't hurt the child. And then there were other reports in other parts of the country. So a few years ago, I know I didn't see a pterodactyl. I saw something, but I've seen a lot of strange things in my life. And I saw this huge bird. We were going down our cottage, my father-in-law, and I looked down this dirt road, and we were riding down on a dirt road, but it was a two-rut road that veered off to the right, and it was kind of a straight for a while, and I looked, and I saw this huge bird. The wingspan covered the whole width of the road, and it wasn't a crane, because cranes have thin legs. I know what a crane looks like from the distance, from behind it. I was just seeing the back end of it, and I saw something very thick, very huge feet. Legs were thick and solid, big wings. It was right getting dark, so at the time, I didn't think too much of it, but I'm always curious. So then I came across an article recently talking about sightings of pterodactyls, or they call them ropins. They call them different names, I guess, pterosaurs maybe. And there was a man that does investigations, and his name is Jonathan Whitcomb. So I sent Jonathan an email, and he said, okay, well, what do you want to do? And I told him, you know, I'm not here to, I'm guessing probably he gets a little bit harassed by what he's investigating. And that's not what my show is all about. We're always exploring and trying to find answers and supportive of the people that come on the show. So from Utah, with that big lead in, He is a cryptozoologist. I'm thinking he's written books. He's written articles. Jonathan Whitcomb. How are you doing, John?
Oh, great. Thank you very much for having me. It's a delight to be here.
And is it true? Have you written books about this? Have you written articles?
Yes, I've written a number of editions. Total number of books now would be... Searching for Opens and Finding God, Live Pterosaurs in America. And then there's an online free book, Live Pterosaurs in Australia and in Papua New Guinea. And then there's another print version of Modern Pterosaurs. So I have four different books, but about maybe nine different editions total of them.
And you started researching this in what year?
I started in 2003, pollination of Granbury, Texas. Had been on a couple of expeditions in Papua New Guinea, searching for these strange flying creatures. And he was getting together some footage from amateur video footage from his expedition on Umboy Island. And we talked on the phone, and he just, within a few days, he sent me the original videotapes of his expedition where they're interviewing natives, and I was fascinated. I should say, as the introduction, that I was a forensic videographer at the time. I produced documentaries for attorney firms, and mostly in Southern California, and day in the life videos. And I was accustomed to, you know, thinking of videos in terms of evidence and, you know, the credibility of eyewitnesses and so on. I might have to be concerned about that when I interview somebody. And I noticed that these natives on these videos were very credible. They weren't perfectly credible to me. They would have been made an impression in court. And so I started investigating and looking into it. And to make a long story short, I was wanting to become part of one of the two expeditions that was supposed to take place in 2004. And so I started preparing for that, and I got everything ready for over a period of a number of months. Unfortunately, one of the expeditions of that year fell through. Pollination was not able to go. And the other one, they were not really planning on me going with them and flying with them to the island on a plane. They had made arrangements just for the two of them. So I said, I'm going to go by myself. So I did what's not recommended. You don't do this. But it's generally not recommended to go to Papua New Guinea alone without anybody waiting there for you. But I was determined. I wanted to go on my own expedition and search out to try to videotape this animal. It's called Ropen on Umbo Island, but that's basically how I got into it.
So Ropen is what the natives call it on the island, and we call it it's pretty much the same thing as a pterodactyl?
Yeah, it's my associates and I are convinced that they are living pterosaurs. You know, Westerners call them pterodactyls. That's generally, that's not technically correct, but it's common. It's a common, you know, man in the street kind of name that you have for the what you think of as like flying dinosaur birds or primitive bird kind of thing. It's featherless, non-bat featherless flying creatures. And anyway, the language on Umboy that we get this word from is the Kovai language. I know almost nothing of it. I can say good morning and not much more. But I did learn some Tokpisin language, which is one of the national languages of that country, of Papua New Guinea. And I was able to help me some on the expedition.
So this was your first into that journey. You had never heard of them or seen these things. I mean, usually when somebody has a fire lit underneath them, it's because they had their own experience. Have you had anything abnormal or weird happen?
No, I'm more kind of the exception. I have, there's about at least a dozen of us that have had major work done, either exploring to some extent or are helping explorers over the years, since 2001. There are 12 that are of us that are really intently into this, and I'm kind of the exception that hasn't had his own sighting. You know, I have a couple of experiences in the last couple of years where I might have seen a living pterosaur, possibly, but they're not good enough sightings that I can really say that I've seen a pterosaur. It's just there were not good enough sightings.
What did you think? What did you see? Can you tell us a little bit? Like,
well,
I'll
tell you one of them. I hesitate because there is possibility misidentification and understand. I mean, I don't want to say that these were two living pterosaurs, but they were somewhat similar to the rope and lights of Papua New Guinea, which I saw up in a mountain in Utah just within the last year or so. And they did look unusual. It's not normally where you'd see something flying at night. And it was two lights. Trying to figure out, it's up near Sandy, Utah, which is in the Salt Lake Valley. I was trying to figure out if they possibly could be have been two of those little remote-controlled helicopters, those drones that are so popular now. It's possible. It doesn't seem to make much sense. See, I was looking in that direction because of a sighting that had no question it was a real bioluminescent pterosaur. And this sounds very strange, I know. It's not just that, you know, pterosaurs are still alive in modern times, but they're glowing, that they have a bioluminescence. But my associates and I believe that that's probably the main origin of the worldwide legends having to do with things like fire-breathing dragons, you know, and flying dragons that have fire. That's where we think that mainly those legends come from. It's from a bioluminescent flying creature.
And we believe, you know, we've proven that, well, I guess we haven't proven. There's some creatures that we think have been extinct, and then we come to find out, I guess not. We find out.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like people hold on to this mentality of, well, no, it's not possible. I didn't see one, blah, blah, blah. And it's like nobody's 100% right. You know, it's keep an open mind because we may find out a year from now, 10 years from now. And sometimes I also think between you and I, John, if you don't mind me calling you John, maybe you go by Jonathan, that there are those that maybe don't want some things to come out. It seems like that's the case with Sasquatch. Nobody really wants the UFOs. I mean, I've experienced UFOs myself, and it seems like they just don't, because maybe it would change the way people think about things or shock them. But,
well, I've known people that have seen UFOs that can't be explained in terms of ordinary things. More than one of my friends over the years, and I think we need to take it seriously, a possibility that they are, it's not a common thing. There is something really strange out there.
Yeah, there's too many reports of it. And there's very credible people when it comes to the tarot source, isn't there? How many cases have you looked at?
Well, I had compiled 128 sighting reports, mostly from persons that I interviewed myself, you know, that I'd had direct communication with. And there were a few that were not from my own interviews, but basically 128 cases that I found more credible. In other words, each of those 128 was more likely than not to have come from an actual encounter with a modern pterosaur. Strange as that sounds, that was my own perception at the time, which was at the end of 2012, I believe, and in the early 2013, I compiled the statistics and found some very interesting things on that show pretty clearly from three different ways that these are not from hoaxes. It's not something you can get these kind of statistical shapes and sizes from any number of hoaxes, except maybe one or two, but 128 very strong cases.
And how far do they date back? How far do they date back?
It varies a lot. You know, when I get a report of my eyewitnesses, usually by email, usually in North America, usually those are in the United States. And I like to get to that soon because it's very interesting. There's a reason why it's from this country rather than so much from other countries. But Americans are accessed to the Internet. They're totally fluent in English. They're always online, and they're searching, and they're not afraid to look up something on the Internet for a period of time till they get the answers they want. So I get a lot of sightings from the United States. And I got so into deep of that, I forgot the original question.
I was just going to ask. I forgot what I asked, actually, Jonathan. I forgot. It was
a different, the credibility of something like that.
Well, I just wondered how many different people have reported it, because, you know, when you start dealing with one or two or ten, you know, then there's room for people to go, well, I don't know. But when you talk about, if you talk about people in the hundreds that have witnessed this, and then if you go back, you know, before man was very advanced, were people seeing this? Well, we have there's a photo, isn't there? A well-known photo, supposedly, of the Civil War, and there's soldiers standing around one of these?
Well, I've written a book. My most recent book is about that, in fact, and that's a deep subject by itself. Well, we could spend time on that, but I call it the PTP photograph for PT for pterosaur and P for photograph. PTP. There are two of them. They're kind of similar. One of them is obviously a hoax, but this one appears to have a number of persons, eyewitnesses, who said they've seen it in the middle of the 20th century or maybe in the 1960s in some kind of old paranormal book. I think I saw it myself. In fact, I have a memory of this myself. But, you know, memory is kind of tricky. It is tricky, especially go back a few decades.
Yeah.
And we're still looking and hoping we're going to find that book or magazine. But basically, that photograph, we've analyzed it with a missile defense physicist, a scientist in California named Clifford Paiva, and we both came to the same conclusion. And just a year ago, last month, we made it official that we're declaring that this is a genuine image of a real animal. It's not a fake photo from Photoshop or something like that. It's a real animal.
You know, and if you have witnesses that go back before the turn of the century, especially, we didn't have a lot of things flying around in the sky. So, you know, for somebody to say, well, I think it was a helicopter, or, well, they didn't have that. They didn't have those things.
Oh, yeah. Let me get an example of that. Certain things you can eliminate generally. You know, when I have, say, there's 128 sighting reports or analyzed at the end of 2012, if I got that number right, I hope that's the right date. I think I have it in front of me. Let me double check. Okay, this is, the compilation was early 2013, but the sightings were compiled basically from the end of 2012. And here's what it is. Not everybody that contacts me has a recent sighting. In other words, I might get a contact next week from somebody that just saw one just hours earlier or just the day before. And, you know, in a state, Louisiana or Kansas or whatever. But there are also those who say, well, I saw one when I was a kid, you know, 25 years ago. And we do have some eyewitnesses who have reported these things going way back in the 1960s and even 1944 in New Guinea, before it was called Papua New Guinea, which is a fascinating case, one of the strongest ones, I believe. So we shouldn't have all these similar kind of things with long tails, no feathers, very large size, head crests of a cone coming out of the back of the head, and have these things going back for decades and still say, oh, it's somebody's drone, you know.
Right.
People didn't have toy drones in 1944 in the Southwest Pacific, flying up from a remote jungle and clearing, you know, in New Guinea. And it's just not a drone. We can eliminate some other things too, if you like. We can go in a number of different directions from here.
To eliminate some of what, I mean, you go back far enough, you're going to realize that there is not these things, you know, the technologies we have now, it's easy to dismiss so many things because of what we do have with the technologies. But there was a time, not even that far ago, when we didn't have all these extra things in the sky. Even 20 years ago, we weren't shipping all these things out. So, you know, people see things, and it, you know, maybe there was a time I was a little more of a skeptic. Although I've been extremely open my whole life, Jonathan, I've always believed in UFOs.
Yeah.
But, you know, I started witnessing things at a young age and seeing things, and then I've just kept an open mind that who's to say that these things, just because we don't see them every day, that they're not out there? And you said that they are more nocturnal, so that would explain a lot. Now, I never heard about the bioluminescent.
Yeah.
That's interesting, that they actually kind of glow, or they're lit up a little bit at night?
Yes, and we need to go back to a scientist in the 1930s. Her name was Cheeseman. Oh, what's her first name? She's a British biologist. I think it's something like, well, I forget her first name. Her name is Cheeseman. She was a British biologist who is well known as the first woman who ever was... had a major employment with that big zoo that they have in London. I forgot the name of that too. But anyway, she was famous for exploring in the Southwest Pacific, and they named a number of species of insects after her. She did a number of different expeditions, and in one of them, she saw these glowing things at night going in a kind of a horizontal kind of line in the distance. It was a number of miles away, and not too many miles, but she analyzed that. She looked the daytime to see where it was. She found that there are certain ridges, and she determined that those glowing lights were definitely not from any human origin. It's not some natives out there with flashlights, you know, in the 1930s going through the jungle. Actually, the lights were above the canopy of the jungle, apparently. She determined it couldn't be that, and she didn't even mention the possibility it could be fireflies, because this is a long distance away. And if any possibility of fireflies, she's an entomologist. I mean, she's an expert in bugs. Mm-hmm. She would have mentioned that. She didn't. In her book, The Two Roads of Papua, I think is the name of the book, she just couldn't come to any conclusion what it was. Well, just a little bit to the east of that location on the mainland of New Guinea is the island of Umboy, and we have sightings of the Ropan there. The glow is consistently said to be about neighborhood of 6 seconds, if I recall. It doesn't last very long, but it's extremely bright when it does come on. And apparently the animal needs time to refresh it. It uses it for landing and for catching fish, but certain amount of time it uses that, and then it uses up the whatever it is, the substance that it produces on or near the skin to produce that bioluminescence. It uses it up, so it has to be dark again until it can refresh that.
Now, these pterodactyls get, or pterosaurs or ropan, how big do they get? They get pretty good size, don't they?
Yeah, and it varies a lot, and this is a complicated question. I can deal with it with the statistics from the beginning of 2013. Let's go to the sizes here. 74 of the 128 estimated the wingspan. It varies tremendously from very small, that's less than 3 feet, up to about 44 feet.
Wow.
And possibly more, but as you get up in the higher ones, I guess more, in other words, they're not rare, but the bigger ones are much less common than the small ones. What happens is when somebody sees a small one, if a small pterosaur or somehow is startled in the daytime and wakes up and flies out, on the corner of your eye, you wouldn't pay attention because it's too much like a bird. And so you don't even look at it. If you don't look at it, you can't see that there's anything unusual about it. It's a bird, you know. That's what you conclude. But if it's very big, like in Southern California in Orange County, near the University of Irvine a number of years ago, if it's as long as the road, which is 30 feet, I measured that road myself by walking across it, 30 feet long, it's going to grab your attention. You're going to turn your head and look at it, and then you will see what it is. Those can be dangerous, the bigger ones, but they're not nearly as common as the small ones.
When you say dangerous, that was my next question, because I was going to ask you, has anybody ever been attacked, or do they know of children or something, or animals, pets being taken by any of these beings?
The first thing we need to look at is direct evidence, actual testimonies of somebody being attacked, and that is, fortunately, is not as common in reported cases that I've gotten a hold of, or somebody sent me, in the United States. But there are other parts of the world where it's more commonly known that people can be attacked, in British Columbia, Canada, for example, and also in Papua New Guinea. We have some cases in the United States, too, and getting to the indirect ones, too. If I see a case now, I look out for this. If somebody says this pterodactyl flew right toward me and it came right toward me and then it passed over my head, I think of that differently now than I did a few years ago. That might have been an attempted attack that was called off. The creature just saw that the man was too big, so he didn't attack it. But we do have attacks. A fisherman, two or three fishermen actually, in the Maryland area, somewhere in Virginia, that part of the country, a number of years ago, they were attacked for some time, and they had to use their fishing poles to just keep whacking at it till it stopped.
Really?
Left them alone.
No kidding. Wow.
I should mention this just in case it might be true, but I don't know for sure. In Florida, years ago, there was one of these newspapers, you know, that give these fantastic reports, and some of them are true and some of them are just made up. And the man with the stub of an arm said that he was attacked by a pterodactyl and it ripped his arm off. Well, I don't know. I haven't been able to get with that person and communicate with him, so I don't know if it's true. But there are things like that do happen where people are attacked sometimes.
We think something that much bigger, We'd be a nice sandwich for him, you know. It's like, oh, hey, you know, look at that.
And I don't know if it was Montana or Wyoming, but there was some place in that part of the country years ago where two men were out just as the sun was about to set, and this huge flying creature flew right over him, and he contacted me. So that means it was probably a good chance it could have been a pterosaur, because people don't contact me if it's just a scary bird or something. They not usually. Anyway, I suspect it could have been a pterosaur, but it was huge, and it passed directly over his head and not too far above him. And I think what happened was he was under attack, and then the animal found us. Oh, that guy's just too big. I'm not going to bother with something that big. It could be dangerous, so he flew off. Another example, in Virginia, at nighttime, this teenage girl was taking a swim in a swimming hole somewhere in Virginia, and this huge flying creature came down and was hovering above her, and she just froze. She did not move. And its wingspan was, it was at least as big, as wide as the pool, and it was not a very small pool. And she was just terrified, petrified, and instinctively she froze and didn't move. The big flying creature, and it was kind of dark, but it just kept flapping, swinging, and hovering there, and then finally gave up and just flew away. I think what it was is it probably heard the girl and came down to see if it was a meal, and then discovered it's something that's not a raccoon, and it's half in the water, half out of the water, and it doesn't know what it is. It's better just to leave it alone. It's not normal prey, so it better just leave it. And so he flew off. Fortunately for the girl.
Yeah. There's I've heard reports of things like that. Now, what do you think that I told you about the story in my email? What do you think? And it didn't have a long tail with this bird, so I know it's not a pterosaur, but I saw something that was really unusual and huge. You think there's another? Maybe there's another? Or did I just see a big owl? I mean, this wingspan covered the road, beyond the road even. At least 12 feet, I would say.
Yeah, I can give you some kind of general probabilities. And what time was this that it happened?
It was right as it was getting dark.
Yeah, right. It's about to get dark. Okay. The probability is more than 50% that what you saw was a living pterosaur, just from what I know, from what you told me. Now, the situation is here's what could happen. There are some reports of very large eagle-like flying creatures or condor-like flying creatures that have feathers that are not obviously pterosaurs because they have feathers. And they are larger than the ones that are known. I don't get too many of these reports, but they do come up occasionally. So some reports of large flying things that are just too big to be normal birds could be actually one of those big birds that are actually literally birds.
Yeah.
And I have to keep that in mind.
So I kind of got the impression maybe it's something like that, because as I look at a picture of the pterodactyl, the ropin, they kind of got skinny little legs, don't they? And they have the wings are connected right almost to the legs. This had normal wings. I couldn't tell if they were feathers, but it had thick feet, big feet.
Yeah.
Like, and maybe this was like a big eagle, bigger than an average eagle that I've ever seen.
It could be. But there are different species of pterosaurs that are actually still living. That's the complicated part.
Oh, I see.
And it's hard to, and that's why I can't, if it was one species, I'd say, oh, it's not a rope, and then you say it's a bird. But unfortunately, it's more complicated. There are more than one species of modern pterosaur. The most common ones are generally called the ropin types, which have long tails. And I haven't been able to come to any firm conclusion about the size of the feet yet. It's just, there's more than one type, and so it's difficult to say.
I should have just stopped the truck and said, hey, stop, I got to get out, and ran down that road, because we just went by it for a second. We weren't going that fast, and I saw this thing flying away, and my father-in-law was driving, and I should have said, hey, hang on, boom, get out of there and run down that road to see what it was, because that was amazing. I've never
since you mentioned that, it could be, I might need to adjust my estimate, but it might be only 40% likely to be a pterosaur if you saw very large legs. But then it's not disprove it, because it's complicated. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There's many different types. Whatever it was, it didn't seem like a typical bird. I've seen eagles. I live in Michigan, so we have those. I've seen owls, but I've never seen anything nearly that big. Getting back to this fascination, what about this picture? How did you... This picture, you have it on some different websites. If people want to check it out, we're going to post it for this interview. But who originally came across the picture? Do you know?
Well, I'll tell you my vague memory. And you can't depend on memory as sometimes completely. You have to take in context that memory changed over time. But I saw this photograph a few years ago after I'd been investigating all these eyewitness reports for years, and I spent over 10,000 hours total on this investigation since 2003. But I didn't want to get into this photograph too much, because there are some things that I'm not sure of at the time, until just 13 months ago. And what happened was I'd had a vague memory of, I think I remember this photograph. It has six, I don't have it in front of me here. Wait a minute, I have a copy of the book in front of me, but it doesn't have the whole photo on the cover. 1, 2, 3, 4, I think it's six soldiers. It's called PTP, and the head of this creature is what really spooked me when I was younger. I saw this thing, and I think it was this photo, and I looked at that head with that long appendage at the back of the head, and it gave me the creeps. I mean, I really felt uneasy at looking at that head. And I remember that was, I've seen something like that, I know, in the 1960s or early 70s, because I have a memory. I used to look for things, unusual things in paranormal magazines and books and things in the library in Pasadena, California, when I was young. And I remember something like that. I can't say for sure that it's identical, but I remember something like that. So I probably is. And I have talked to other persons, Mr. Payne, who is he actually builds canoes, and he said that's not those are not canoes that are looking like wings. They're sort of like canoe-like appearance in this particular picture. So that was my impression. Why does that thing look like canoes? The wings look like canoes. And so I didn't investigate until just 13 months ago.
Yeah, I looked at that picture too, and it looks pretty, of course, what do I know? It looks pretty authentic, but it looks like the right, you know, obviously it could be faked, and you took some heat over that, didn't you, for somebody calling
it? Yeah, I mean, I have a lot of skeptics that come with all kinds of things. We should mention, though, that Clifford Pive and I have examined this objectively. He's believed for many years that it's an authentic pterosaur. But we have to be objective and look at the possibility that it might be some type of very elaborate hoax of some type. So we didn't take a position until 13 months ago when we, you know, together took an official position on it. I can tell you a number of things about that. The things that I noticed, I used to be a professional videographer in photography and video. And I was thinking, well, if this is real, it should have some evidence that it was probably shot, or they found a dead one out in the underbrush somewhere, and then they dragged it into the clearing there so that the photographer could take a photograph of it. Assuming that this is 19th century, of course, we're assuming just for the sake of possibility, they would have dragged it. And I looked, and sure enough, there's a drag mark that comes right across the lower right part of the photograph. When you're looking at the photograph, there's the drag mark, very plain, and there's a little broken sapling tree right there, which looks like very obviously somebody could have broken that down so that they could have just carried the creature out into that clearing there so that the photographer would photograph it. So that's just one example of the evidences that we see that it's something authentic here.
And those soldiers, are they Civil War soldiers or just Union soldiers?
Well, good question. Here's the thing. Pive is a physicist, and my experience, so he knows about, he's the kind of physicist that examines photographs and dealing with missiles and missile defense and so on. And so he knows how to examine photographs to get evidence of what's in a photo. And my background is more like from experience as an actual being out there as a camera operator and so on. And so we're coming from this from different perspectives, and that made me get too deeply in those things. Now I forgot the original question again.
I was just wondering if the soldiers, because I'm looking at the picture right now, and I see the soldiers.
Oh, yeah. Oh, they're Civil War photos, Civil War soldiers. Pive and I believe that the photograph was taken after the end of the Civil War, but not long after. The type of posing that's involved, Pive and I think, is similar to what would have been taking place, especially before 1870, because photography after about 1870 was a better quality, and they didn't need to have so many seconds to get the exposure. But this one shows the, for example, something like a block of wood or something under the beak, and they have the soldiers holding their rifles in such a way that it could make them easier to keep their bodies steady. It's just certain things in there having to do with propping that looks like the wing was propped up, for example, that Pive has shown. It just looks like it was propped up in a way that would be consistent with the before 1870. And that's not absolute proof, but it's just kind of pointing that direction. We believe that the soldiers were Reconstruction, perhaps, maybe Reconstruction-era soldiers.
Okay.
Soon after the Civil War.
That would make sense as I look at them, because they definitely look Union soldier, but they don't look like the typical Union soldier. And I mean, it's hard to tell because it's kind of not a black and white. I guess it's a black and white photo, isn't it?
And it turned yellow. But what happened was You have to keep in mind this. One of the things that one or two skeptics have mentioned is, oh, they don't have the ammunition. They don't have the ammunition on their shoulder. Well, why would they? I mean, if it's after the Civil War, you know, they wouldn't necessarily have to have ammunition on their shoulder, you know, right there on them. That doesn't mean that it's not authentic, that this is some kind of fake. You have to be careful what you're assuming. And a lot of the assumptions that are made that try to say that this are not, that these are not Civil War soldiers. Well, Pipe and I don't say that the photograph was taken actually literally during the Civil War. It's just that general era of the 19th century, and possibly it could have been as late as 1870.
I couldn't imagine if these guys, you know, they come across this and they get this bird and then they get that picture. And of course, you know, pictures weren't taken as often. If it's 1870-ish, you know, photography was coming around, but it still was a long ways away, and it wasn't as common. And also, as I look at the faces on here, you know, I know they instructed people not to smile back then. That was safe.
Well, I think it's more the custom than more of a tradition, more than an instruction, I think. But yeah, go ahead.
The children could smile, but the adults were told not to. I remember reading something about that recently, and that was all the way into the 1900s, where people had that more serious look on their face for whatever reason it was. And each one of these guys looks pretty serious. Of course, if I came across that, I'd be pretty serious, too. I'd be going, what the heck? So how do these things avoid, they must hide away somewhere, or is there another place they go? Where do they go that we can't see them?
Well, we need to keep in mind that North America, even today in the 21st century, North America, including the 48 contiguous states of the United States, is mostly either one or two things. It's either wilderness or it's remote areas where they're not heavily populated. The real human population centers are cities and towns, and those are just specks, you know, scattered across the North America. So there are plenty of places to hide. This is not a problem. The problem we have, too, is that they're nocturnal. And probably the biggest problem at all, which just takes out everything, is that these are animals that were just assumed in our society. They're extinct. I mean, we're taught from early childhood that the dinosaurs and pterosaurs became extinct millions of years ago, long a time ago. They're all dead. I remember I started talking to one of the kindergarten boy once a few years ago, and I just mentioned what I was doing, and he immediately said two words, a comet. That was his words.
What?
So kindergartners are totally aware that these animals are not supposed to be alive. So when an American or some other European or some Western or Canadian, for example, when they see a living pterosaur, one of the things that they have to deal with are, am I crazy? I couldn't have seen a pterodactyl flying overhead. Am I crazy? What happened? What was that? What's going on? And so we have strange ideas, like people who are just ordinary, healthy, mentally healthy people who suddenly have a thought that maybe they're hallucinated something. And so the vast majority of people don't report these. I mean, the vast majority. If I get one sighting report, for example, last month, one sighting report in North Carolina, I can assume that there are over 1,000 people who've seen a living pterosaur in North Carolina during a period of a few years. It's just the way that the reports come in. And I know this, it's a long story, but I know this from certain eyewitnesses who report that they know somebody else that saw one, and they saw one, and they know somebody else, you know. It's just lots of people have seen these.
People are afraid to come forward. This is my experience in dealing with paranormal, and we do a lot of that on this program. Anything unknown. I mean, the dog man, have you ever heard of the man-wolf dog man? Have you heard of that?
Yeah. There's lots of different things in North America. The United States has all kinds of things.
So Sasquatch, and next week I'm going to have a show with a man who does Sasquatch research up here in this area in Michigan, upper Michigan. And, you know, there's just so many credible people, I think, that are, maybe some are mistaken it, but I think so many are spot on with what they're seeing. And I think some of these creatures, and I can't say this about the pterodactyl or the pterosaurs, Some of these creatures, I think, go to another place. I think there's a door that somehow they open, or a doorway that opens, and they enter and they leave. And this is why maybe we don't see them all the time. A good friend of mine who's Native American told me he saw a Sasquatch walk right into a tree and disappear. And he said they know how to open doorways to other places, to other dimensions. And that's similar to the man wolf. Linda Godfrey does research on that. She's been on different programs and on History Channel, those kind of things. And she talked about how she felt maybe they also entered a place like a doorway, and then they show up here and then they're gone, because they just disappear so quickly. And maybe some are staying around, hanging around. But there's even speculation that I'm guessing you also believe in the Loch Ness and those type of creatures, because I do as well, that I can. And some are speculating that maybe there's another doorway that they come and go from, because they're not always there. They've done sonar in the lakes or in the loch, and those things aren't there. But then the next thing you know, somebody sees them sticking their head up. So
yeah, I've been to Loch Ness once, only briefly. I wasn't able to do anything like research, but just to visit the lake. But that's beyond my expertise. You know, but I can say that there are certain things that doesn't seem to apply with certain terrace or sightings. In Umbo Island, for example, I've got statistics about the times that people see the light flying from a mountain to the reef on the coast, and then the other times when they fly the other direction from the coast up into the mountains. And it seems to correspond with a nocturnal animal that's traveling from the mountains, and as soon as the sun sets, it'll fly out to the reef to catch food, fish, or whatever. And then before the sun comes up again, it will fly back to a mountain. So it's sort of leading to concepts of a real animal that lives there on the island, at least in that case. Yeah.
So my theory of entering other dimensions probably doesn't work for that so much.
Doesn't look too good on Umbo, no.
But as for these other things, maybe it explains why they seem to come and go. And then, you know, there's always the argument, well, how come people don't find a skeleton or a body somewhere, you know, if these things do exist, like with Sasquatch, you hear that all the time. And what is your answer to that, John?
Well, there's a number of things to consider. First of all, people say things like that, and basically they're making a number of assumptions, and all the assumptions have to be right for that to be thought. They assume that if somebody were, for example, to be taking a hike in the mountains of Tennessee, for example, and they come across a skeleton of a pterosaur, they assume that, oh, if they find the pterosaur, oh, if they take it to a university and they announce that it's a discovered modern pterosaur that just died recently, and, you know, it's in the newspapers, and it becomes common knowledge in the Western world that pterosaurs are still alive. That's a fictional story. I mean, none of those things are going to happen. What we have is some rotten carcass somewhere that stinks and that people don't want to touch, and they don't know what it is, so they just leave it alone, and they forget about it, and they just walk by. They're, you know, the hiker is there to hike, not to drag a big dead thing home that they don't know what it is. And the other thing is that how are you going to transport it, even if it's a small one? You're going to go back to your house and get a big plastic bag, put in a plastic bag, and then take it home. And then, I mean, I've been through something similar to this before with a dung specimen, and it turned out to be probably from a raccoon. But it's just not practical. When something dies, it usually dies in the underbrush, and it decomposes. I'll give you an example in Central California. My parents lived up there in the mountains near Yosemite, and we had a family project. We'd bury all these little dead animals. We'd bury them somewhere and measure precisely where they are, so we know exactly where to come back to and get the bones of these dead animals. And we'll find their bones 12 months, you know, in the next family vacation in the summer. We come back there 12 months later, and the bones, not only the flesh is decomposed, but the bones have disappeared. We kept digging. Things decompose in the wild.
Oh, yeah.
They just don't last that long.
Oh, yeah. Just not that long ago, it was, I think it was fall, and I live out in a wooded area. I mean, I'm not far off the highway, but there's woods kind of surrounding my property, and then there's the highway about 100 yards away. And I was walking through behind my property, and I looked over, and I saw a skeleton of a deer, which kind of surprised me. And that was gone in just a very short time. You know, I went back there again, and it was gone. So it's amazing how quickly things can disappear on us.
Yeah, true. And it's a lot of wilderness and semi-wilderness area we have to deal with, too. It's just people are not looking for these things, too. They're not looking for a body of a pterodactyl. Who's going to be looking for it? I had a situation where I had some sightings in Los Angeles, city of Los Angeles.
Really?
And it was near Griffith Park. Within a period of a few weeks, there were two different eyewitnesses. One of them said it was a dragon that was flying near the freeway there east of Griffith Park. And the other one said something similar, and they both contacted me because they thought it was pterosaurs. And I went there, and I found out that this one little park that was fenced off, it was a very small little park and had little water there. It was where the water department was using it for something. And it was a chain link fence, so you can just, you can see into this little attractive little area with trees and a little pond. And I looked at, and I walked around, and I looked at all the people that lived there that were walking past. Every person that was walking past that park never looked through the chain link fence into the enclosure. They knew what it was, and they just never looked in there because they knew what it was. If there was a pterodactyl sitting there asleep in the daytime next to the pond, nobody would notice. And at nighttime, it would just fly off to somewhere else. It's just people are not watching for them.
Yeah, and there's probably not that many. Any idea how many you think are in the United States? Is there an estimation?
Well, I can't say anything like that in terms of, you know, actually estimating number, but I can tell you the number of sighting reports, how they relate to human populations. Like, for example, if you get it down to a 6 million humans, and that's a typical state in the United States, there's an average of 3.1 sightings per 6 million humans in an average state. Hawaii is huge. It's just way in the first place with 44.1 sightings per 6 million humans. The second place is Utah, 19.5, and Oklahoma is third with 11.2. That means that you know, we have a extraordinary number of sightings in Hawaii, which probably has a lot to do with this, a lot of people being outdoors a lot of the time and looking around. That's what people do in Hawaii. But in Utah and in Oklahoma, we have something that we learn something different. These are not frigate birds. Those big oceanic birds that are called frigates, they're found in the tropical areas, and they fly over the ocean. They're oceanic birds. You would not have misidentified frigates, and that's one of the biggest things that critics have said a few years ago was that, oh, these are just frigate birds that are people misidentifying. Well, frigate birds would not, you know, accumulate in numbers in Utah and Oklahoma, you know, middle of North America. They just don't do that, and also not in just northern Oklahoma here. Let's see, that would be Kansas and Arkansas. Yeah, those are not frigate birds, definitely.
Mm-hmm. So, and there can be many different types of these pterodactyls. So they were estimated to die out when the dinosaurs died out, which was, how long ago was that supposed to be? How many millions of years ago?
About 66 million. But here's the interesting thing is that the scientists have two main classes of pterosaurs they know about. Basically, they're the basal pterosaurs or rhamphorhynchoids, which are believed by many scientists to have basically lived more earlier, over 100 million years ago, for example. And then later came the pterodactyloids, which have little or no tails, and they have a different way the head connects with the neck. So, but the pterodactyloids are the ones like you see in one of the Jurassic movies, Jurassic Park movies.
Okay.
Where they escape and attack people. Those are the pterodactyloids. In particular, those were, I believe, pteranodons, which is a type of pterodactyloid. But the ones that we have mostly seen in modern times is the rhamphorhynchoids, which are the ones that are supposed to have become extinct a long time ago. But that's the vast majority. For example, look at the statistic here. Consider this statistic. A long tail is found in 41% of those that reported the sighting of a apparent pterosaur. 41% long tail. Only 2% say that there's not a long tail. That's a good 20-to-1 ratio. That's statistically significant, 20-to-1 ratio. And the sightings I had since then, since the beginning of 2013, seem to be the same. I haven't compiled them, you know, and analyzed in that detail, but they seem to be the same. People are seeing rhamphorhynchoids. Ropan is a rhamphorhynchoid, you know, according to the beliefs of my associates and I. It's a rhamphorhynchoid.
What is a rhamphorhynchoid?
It's the kind of pterosaur that has the long tail, often with a flange at the end, like a diamond kind of shape at the end,
okay.
Which is
a
flange that helps in the maneuvering. I can give you an example, which is kind of interesting. In let me see what state. It's in the Midwest. What state was it? It's in Indiana, if I remember right, or one of those states in that part of the country. Don't hold me to that. It might not be Indiana, but
okay.
It's in the Midwest.
There's
this river. It's a very hot summer day, and this man was going across the this bridge on this river, and he saw this pterodactyl, he said, with a long tail and a diamond kind of shape at the end or something of that nature. And it was flying. It was chasing sparrows, and he said he saw the thing actually catch a sparrow in his mouth after it passed passed across the bridge. I think he said it flew over the bridge, if I recall. And he stopped his car and looked at it and saw it actually catch the sparrow in his mouth. Now that's not a drone. It's not a drone pterodactyl or remote control device. You know, it was an animal that caught it
mm-hmm.
in its mouth. But that's an example of what we call a ropan. Modern pterosaur, yeah.
Wow. So, and there could be many different...
I don't know how many different species are there. There are two general types. The most common is a rhamphorhynchoid, and that's the ones that people don't see too much in movies. They're more common to see the Jurassic Park kind of pterodactyloid, which has a short tail or almost no tail at all.
Okay. Maybe that's what I saw. The one I saw didn't have really a tail. I don't recall.
Yeah, that's why I think maybe what you saw is a pterodactyloid, because it could be a greater possibility that that type would have larger legs and feet on them, if possible.
Do you know if anybody has like videos or other pictures out there of these things that you're aware of?
Well, what we really were thinking about is a good video that's very clear. Yeah, that's the problem. We have one that's in the... North Carolina, Raleigh, North Carolina, which is a short video, which probably is genuine. I believe it's genuine. Unfortunately, the young lady was just gotten into the city bus, and the bus had just pulled out, and she was trying to videotape it through the windows. She thought there were two of them, and she videotaped them, and I do see them. There is a possibility, I see some evidence possible of a flange that could be at the end of a tail, but then again, it could be possibly, if you're going to just be to take the skeptical side, it could be just the feet on a regular bird, another kind of bird, heron or whatever that has its feet
crane
out.
Crane like or something like that, yeah.
Crane, yeah. And so it's not that good an evidence by itself. We do have the lady's testimony that she's seen them more than once. She looks for these. In other words, she's one of those who's in Raleigh, Carolina, who's really keeping a lookout for a number of months. To watch for these, because other people have seen them too, and she's seen them a number of months earlier. So she's always watching for them. I suspect if she has another sighting, she'll give me another email or a phone call.
Did you ever hear a story about, because it was on a TV show that I saw it about, I think it was Illinois or Ohio or somewhere in there, about a woman claimed that one of these tried to pick up her son. Did you ever?
Yeah, I think that's the Illinois account, and that one sounds like one of those birds. If I recall, I think this is one of those reports where there's a kind of a white ring around the neck. Is that one? If I'm not mistaken, I think it's that kind of bird. It is probably, if that's the one that I'm thinking of, and if I'm remembering it right, and I could be mixing it up with something else because I get so many of these reports over the years, but if it did have a white ring around the neck, it probably literally is a bird. It's just not a bird that's known to science. It's a large bird, bigger than the bald eagle.
What they call the thunderbird? Is that?
Well, the thunderbird is a label. That's the challenge we have, is the difficulties. People say, I saw a thunderbird, or that this is, thunderbirds exist here in this part of the country. Thunderbird is a label. It's not a something that, you know, scientists have in a laboratory that they've examined and saying this is what it is. This is a thunderbird, and then they label it, and then this is photographed and put in the book, and the title of that chapter is Thunderbird. You know, it's not scientific. It's just a label that people have for it. So you have to deal with what I say. If you really want to learn something, you need to deal with one particular sighting and analyze it, what it is, and see if it resembles something we know as living, or something we know from the fossils, or, you know, something, you know, like that. We need to be specific and look at the details in the sighting reports.
You know, there's probably so many things out there, Jonathan, that we're just scratching the surface. I think there's a lot of unknown things. And even, you know, I think a lot of the legends that we have about these mythical creatures, I think there probably was some truth in those things. I don't think people were making that stuff. Too many people would talk about them. And there was a time that especially Native peoples believed in certain things and were aware of them. And they knew how to respect them and stay away from them and be careful of them. And so we've gone through our whole history, and all of a sudden now we have all the answers. It's like, well, we got science now. We got it all figured out. We don't need to. And it's like, and yet we don't. We still don't know how they made the pyramids, and we still don't know how they did all these other things. But we got it all figured out about pterodactyls and Sasquatch and whatever else is out there. And it's like, I don't think you do. And I also think there is also, do you ever feel like there is an element out there that is doing disinformation, even with what you're doing?
Well, definitely, in the sense that there are skeptics that are trying very hard to make people disbelieve and ignore me and my research and the things that my associates have done and all that they've written. My associates haven't written as much as I have, but they have done a lot of things like lectures and expeditions and so on. I just have the biggest mouth. I'm the biggest big mouth in the world in this subject. That's just me.
But you're not afraid to talk about it.
Yeah. But yeah, there's skeptics in particular. One, I won't mention his name, but it's a skeptic that's written a huge amount on one website. He has tens of thousands of words. It's like the size of a book, but it's an online web page. And he mentions me by name over 300 times.
Wow.
I counted them. Over 300 times. I think it's 344, 345. One time he misspelled my name. I don't count that one. This doesn't count.
Why would somebody go through that much trouble to... I mean, what joy does that give people to... I think it's good to be skeptical and good to have doubts, but also keep an open mind. We shouldn't believe everything we see or hear, but also believe that the potential for something else is there. But what makes somebody, unless they're being paid to do that, what makes somebody want to do that?
Well, I can't read somebody's mind. Don't mention any names, because because this person, sometimes he will find a mistake, or else he'll find it from me or from someone. He'll find a mistake and he'll correct his mistake. The problem is that he really is not objectively looking at it. He's looking for every possible reason to find fault with every single sighting report, which is huge numbers of reports, and it just goes back for centuries. And he's looking for every single one, and he mentions every single reason why it's not a real pterosaur. And I think it's probably something in his own thinking that he feels uncomfortable with that. You know, he wants to protect the standard models of geological time and so on. He wants to protect all that and not have anybody doubt, you know, modern scientific ideas and so on. And so he wants to protect that kind of science way of thinking. He wants to protect it, and so he has to find all the evidence against it and try to make people disbelieve.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. But I would also, if I take it down the road of conspiracy, which I sometimes do, not too much on this show, but I would say that he's probably paid to throw some disinformation, you know, throw some disinformation on you.
I'm not sure. He might be retired now. I'm not sure. So he might actually have time to do this. He's really into it. I mean, he's been doing this for many years. I would kind of doubt that he's being paid directly, but it's possible. But I think that it's easier to take the case for, not literal conspiracy, but more like what you call it appears to be conspiracy, not literal conspiracy. It's just that people have certain, they all want to, they all want to protect their own paleontology experiments and their own writings in paleontology, geology, and so on. And so they just happen to take the same kind of skeptical views, and they jump on anything
right.
that makes it look bad. I mean, I could tell you stories. I've interviewed a number of times the late Dwayne Hodgkinson and my associate Garth Gessman from California. He's interviewed him in camera, and I've edited the video. We put it on YouTube, and it's has a third of a million views. It's very credible eyewitness, this young soldier that was in the jungle. We've interviewed him in detail and done studies of what he tells us, and yet the skeptic, he's not interviewed anybody over this last 12 years or so, never interviewed anybody, and he assumes he can just, you know, that he can just take any statement in this and assume that that's it, and so he thinks that it's not worth anything, but it's a very credible eyewitness. And
you know, when you do say about people hanging on to things because they don't want to, you know, part of it's ego, probably most of it, we have a group of people that meet up here every year. They get together, and people from all over the country come. It's Ancient Artifact Preservation Society, and they have discovered what they believe to be mining of copper that dates back 6,000 or 7,000 years, and they believe that the Celts were here, amongst other groups, because they found Celtic prayer stones and different things that would show that it was a Celtic group of people and other groups from Europe that were coming here. So how much would that change our history? And so, like you said, maybe some people don't, we don't want to change that, and we don't want to give up what we believe, because what we believe is right. And so you get the mindset, the egos, and somebody told me, and I don't know, I can't remember who I interviewed, but the man told me, he said, you know, it's hard for people to let go of what they really want to believe, and there's egos there because I'm right and you're wrong. So that's part of it.
Yeah, and some people, they just feel comfortable with this idea that, oh, science has all the answers, you know, science, you know, is it, that's the truth, you know, and everything. Well, real science in the Western world and in history, it's been always making new discoveries and refining theories, you know. It's real science involves the possibility that what we used to think is wrong. That's, you keep discovering, you and examine things, and even the speed of light, you know, I've had one scientist has even showed there's documented evidence, that the measurements of the speed of light vary in a way that there's no pattern to it. The speed of light is not always constant. It's not a given constant that never changes. It has a certain range where it will change in its value, and this is known from experiments. But it's, of course, you read the standard textbooks, and they'll say it's exact. Speed of light is precise, and it's always the same. You know,
that's a good point. That's a real good point. And I don't know how you couldn't, if you were trying to find answers, that you wouldn't have an open mind to seek and be willing to change your opinion on things.
Well, you know, sometimes I found, too, it's interesting that people who have been in some field of paranormal, they deal with unusual things, they're more likely, I believe, to report to me what they've seen, if they've seen something like a living pterosaur. For example, in California years ago with a couple who were doing research on ghost investigations, and they reported this. The lady reported her sighting, a close-up encounter with a dragon pterodactyl, as she called it, in her backyard in the middle of the day, and clearly in view, and nothing between her, is about, you know, I think about 8 to 20 feet between the end of her nose and the end of the tail of the creature.
Oh.
She saw it, you know, she got a good view of it. And I think the reason that she reported it was she was one of those persons that's just more likely to talk about and believe in something unusual because she's researched another type of paranormal field.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think not only that, but I sometimes, and I kind of think everything happens by, there's no accidents. There's no accidents in what happens in our life. So if we witness something, that's not by accident. Even with creatures that we think animals, maybe we think they're not as intelligent, but I think there's divine intelligence in everything. So it shows up on your doorstep. There's a reason for it to be there. And maybe it's meant for you to talk about it.
Yeah. Oh, no, it's definitely. There's a purpose in life, purpose in existence, and there's intelligence that is beyond our knowledge now. I mean, should I go off the topic? But they found that some dogs could know when their master is coming home.
Yeah.
The man and the woman that comes home at a certain time, they know when the person decides to come home, even if it's miles away, but their dog knows when the person has made a decision to get in the car and drive home. they've tested it. There's intelligence here that was beyond our...
And it seems to be linked through our thoughts. I think we are all connected by our thoughts, and so animals are connected to us, and so even a pterodactyl... it's all part of a divine kingdom, and we are all connected to it. And I also think it's part of our journey sometimes. You know, things show up to us that are meant to show up to us. And a lot of times for people, like you said, maybe it's to wake us up. You know, some of these things happen to us to wake us up. I know in my case, these things that happened to me got me to look deeper and explore more.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I'm sure it would. I mean, I mean, I like to have my own sighting of something unusual myself, but I appreciate that at least I have this feeling that these are important eyewitnesses and they need to be heard. And I'm glad I can help them to know they're not crazy. It's just people see these. You're not crazy for seeing it. It's just you happen to be there for some reason. You really had the privilege of seeing that.
If the creatures that are in the water, whatever you want to call them, what are they called, those plesiosaurs or...
Plesiosaurs.
Plesiosaurs. If those are still around, which I believe they are, there's been too many sightings. There's the Champ that's in... what lake is that?
Yeah, Lake Champlain. My uncle has seen something, some kind of sea serpent in off the coast of California, Central California, a long time ago, and I was fascinated by that.
There's reports up here. There was a woman who researched and wrote a book about early reports of unusual stories in Upper Michigan.
Oh,
and there's
there's
a lake called Lake Autrain, Autrain Lake, and then it's not far from Lake Superior. And one of the stories was, and this was written back in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and these two guys were fishing on a lake, on Autrain Lake, which has a river that runs right into Lake Superior. And they saw a serpent-like creature, and you kind of cracked me up when you said these people were beating this thing away with. They had their oars, and that's what they're doing to this thing, this serpent, because they saw it on the water. And she said, you know, these are just stories written from a different time when they didn't kind of, they alter the truth now a lot, or they just don't report things. Back then, they just reported stories as they heard them. There was no filter. And that's why I think in some ways the news or the stories that we heard back then were probably more accurate.
Well, in some ways, definitely. I'm sure they would be. In other ways, there could be some problems. But, you know, we need to try to take the big picture and look at a lot of different things from different times and see what's similar, what we can find that's similar in them.
Yeah, if there's several stories going on from a different time, then that, you know, one story is not going to probably be the answer. But if you hear it over and over again, and it's a similar story, to me, that's when I start to believe. Because there must be things, too, with you, Jonathan. When you first hear him, you go, nah, that's not real. You ever do that?
Yeah, oh, boy. Yeah, it was only after I've been researching for years and years that one of my sisters, she said, oh, remember our friend and when we were teenagers back in the 1960s in Pasadena, California? She saw a giant pterodactyl flying up in the mountains. Right, you know, north of in Altadena, which is north of Pasadena, it was big as a bus. It was huge. It wasn't a buzzard. And I know that if I had heard that story in the 1960s myself, I would have thought, "Oh boy, my sister's friend is loony. You know, she doesn't know what she's talking about." Now I think, "Wow, it's exactly what she thought it was. It was a gigantic pterodactyl.
Yeah, funny how we change our way of thinking. But every time I'm introduced to something new, I always kind of go, well, I don't know. And then, and you know, I explore everything and anything. So you hear so many different things that are out there. But I've come to believe that there's probably some truth in all of it. Or maybe it's some of it's not accurate. But why dismiss it away completely without keeping an open mind?
Yeah. True.
Is there anything else you want to tell us about any coming upcoming books or?
Well, mainly I want people to contact me with any kind of sighting that they've had or that they know of a sighting that their friend or family member has had. Get in touch with me. Look up Whitcomb, W-H-I-T-C-O-M-B, contact or about Whitcomb or contact Whitcomb or something. So contact me. Let me know what it is. And I have an open mind. I'd like to know.
Me too. I'd love to see one of those. You know, it's fascinating. There's so many things out there in the universe, so many things here in our world. And not just, if you travel outside this country, there's different legends in every part of the world of different types of creatures. And we tend to just look at what's here. And some of these creatures are similar in other parts of the world, such as the abominable snowman, Yeti, similar to Sasquatch. And when you start comparing the two, you know, it seems like the Yeti has the ability, is colored white a lot of time. But then I talked to a woman from Lower Michigan, and she saw a Sasquatch, and she said it was white, and it was wintertime. And I thought, maybe they changed their color to blend in.
Yeah, who knows? Wow.
So it just makes you realize that all over the world, there are fascinating things that we haven't completely figured out. And some of those things, I think, have the ability to come and go, and that's why we can't pin them down. Maybe the pterodactyls don't enter into another dimension. Woo! You know, maybe they don't do that. Maybe they're right in front of our nose, and we just don't see them. And if they come out at night, I'm going to start having to look around more at night when I see some lights. Luminescent.
Yeah.
The whole body is luminescent?
It varies, and again, probably there's more than one species that might have a different way of doing it. We have some in all over the North America, bioluminescence, Texas, Oregon, Washington State. In the Midwest. There's a lot to learn. I'm still trying to get a handle on it.
And you've only been working on it for how many years now? What is it, 15?
The middle of 2003, so it's quite a few years.
Well, it's really nice talking to you, Jonathan, and I would love to talk to you again if you get more updates or want to share stories or if you have a book or anything you want to talk about. I'd be glad to do that and help maybe bring the little truth forward if that's possible. So,
Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you.